Would grab a New Testament and turn to 1 Timothy chapter 2. We're going to continue our thoughts from last Sunday that we started on the text of 1 Timothy 2 and verses 9 through 10. So we'll be there in a moment. It's wonderful to be with everyone. It's always a joy to gather with those who share that precious faith in Christ and worship God. I've been encouraged by your presence. I know that you have been encouraged by the worship and edified. I hope that continues this morning as we study the scriptures. I think we're all ready for the heat to be gone for good. We're enjoying the cool weather this morning. September's just around the corner, next Sunday being the first of that month, so fall's drawing near. And so that's a wonderful thing. We'll be able to gather in a little bit more comfort in regard to the heat being gone. But it's wonderful to be with you here this morning and to be able to worship God with you. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9, we find our text where Paul writes, "In like manner," that is as it pertains to the likeness of the instruction for the men, "in like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works." We considered that text last Sunday in some detail, and we considered what modest dress was, and we even asked the question, can we draw a line? God tells us to dress modestly, and so if we're to observe that command, how are we to dress modestly? And so we reached the conclusion that a line must be drawn, else we don't know what is sufficient clothing. And we discuss that, especially as it pertains to the word that we're to dress in modesty with propriety. It's an honorable shame, which considers nakedness to be shameful. So we dress to cover up that nakedness, lest we have our shame exposed. We noted that nakedness can be in totality without clothing at all. We noted also, though, especially as it pertains to examples in the Old Testament, that we can be clothed and still be naked. And so modest dress is that which covers nakedness, that which dresses with sufficient amount of clothing. So what is sufficient clothing? You tell me, I tell you. Well, we can't give a standard that is without subjectivity unless, if God commands us to be modest, if he does indeed give us a standard. So we drew that line. We noted the legitimacy of drawing that line, that the whole concept of orderly apparel, that is modest apparel as it relates to the Greek term, kosmios, is something which boasts of and requires law. Where there is order, there must be law. Where there is law, there must be order. And so if we're to dress orderly, there must be a law of dress. And we drew that line. We defined nakedness from the Old Testament. We also noted the legitimacy of going to the Old Testament. Just recently in our teen class, we studied the illegitimacy and the sin of binding the Old Testament in the era of Christianity when Christ speaks according to his new law. The old law was nailed to the cross, but what we also noted last Sunday is that we didn't bind the old law, we simply defined the term of nakedness, which was defined for us in the account of Adam and Eve in Genesis, which was before the Mosaical period, the Mosaic dispensation, and we know that nakedness is the same today as it was back then, and who would be bold enough to argue otherwise. And so we noted the legitimacy of going to the Old Testament to define nakedness so that we could define what modest dress was, that dress which covers nakedness. Why is it so important to dress modestly, though? We touched on it a bit, especially as it pertains to the text. But I want to be a little more practical about it this morning concerning why we need to dress modestly as it pertains to our profession as Christians, namely, as the text says, those who profess godliness, and we profess godliness especially through our good works, that is the works of obedience to God's law. And it is also needful to note, just before we get any further, that while this example and this instruction pertains to the women in the worship assembly, that they're to dress modest not only in the worship assembly, but obviously to dress modestly, period, that they would come to worship in modest apparel. That means they were in modest apparel before worship, but also that while it pertains especially to women in this text, because it is certainly a struggle more for women, as we understand, and as it was even in this culture, that it also pertains to men. Men must dress modestly. If men are not dressed according to the standard that God has set for our dress, then they are sinning just as much as a woman would be sinning to dress immodestly. We noted that God dressed Adam and Eve both with the exact same thing, and we defined what that was as it pertains to the length of covering from the shoulders down to the knees. We'll touch on that a little bit more in this lesson. But I want us to consider that, especially in a practical manner, as it pertains to our conduct and character as a Christian. And I want us to consider that there are two ends of a spectrum in modest apparel. When we discuss modest apparel and modesty, there are two opposite ends of the spectrum. There is what we might describe as ostentatious apparel that is immodest. And then there is apparel that we might describe as sexually attractive apparel that is immodest. The ostentatious apparel is an excess of apparel. It is too much, and we'll understand why in a moment. And then the sexually attractive apparel, which is immodest, is not enough apparel, insufficient clothing. It's clothing that doesn't cover nakedness. And we want to consider that in a little bit of detail and practicality, I hope, this morning. So I hope you can follow it and make proper application. But first, I think it's necessary to quickly review the text, the terminology. He tells those brethren there that women are to adorn themselves in modest apparel. And this is how you do that, with these adjectives, with these modifiers, with propriety and moderation. And this is to the goal of professing godliness, namely with good works. The Greek word adorn is kosmeo, and it means to arrange and put in order. And what we noted last time is that implies a concerted effort. If I'm putting something in order, it takes effort. Me and Zoe, for some reason, just recently started doing puzzles, and it's been pretty enjoyable. She's enjoyed it a little more than I have and put most of it together. But first, you got to find the edge pieces. Then you've got to put them in different categories. These have the color of the sky in the picture we're trying to put together. These have the color of the ground, so on and so forth. And you're putting things in order. You're arranging things so you can put the puzzle together. And it takes time. It takes effort. It takes thought. And that's what we're talking about here. We're adorning ourselves. We're arranging ourselves in apparel. That's the third word, katastole, which just means clothes, a garment. But it is apparel that is modest, which is akin to kosmeo. It is kosmios. And it means orderly or decorous. But we noted, as it is translated in the third chapter of 1 Timothy 2, in a qualification of an elder as good behavior, same exact Greek word, translated modest here, translated good behavior, that it is not simply an outward thing. It is certainly partly outward, but it's not simply outward. Kosmios has more to do with the outward man that reflects the inward man. R.C. Trench explains, the well-ordering is not of dress and demeanor only, but of the inner life, uttering indeed and expressing itself in the outward conversation. We noted that this very text teaches the understanding and idea that, yes, our outward man reflects who we are truly on the inside. And so the whole claim that we can wear what I want because God only looks at the heart is a fallacy. Because what we wear, what we are outwardly, shows what we are inwardly. So arrange ourselves takes effort. An apparel which reflects a good behavior, that good behavior, obviously, is modified by us being Christians. It's behavior which is right before God. And so he goes on to give us two descriptions of what modest apparel is. Things that we need to have in our person in order to be successful dressing modestly. And that is, we must have propriety. It's the Greek word eidos, and it means a sense of shame, modesty. It is honorable shame. There are things that are honorable to be ashamed of. And we noted that it is especially an inner decency which recognizes the lack of clothing to be shameful. In Isaiah, the 20th chapter, nakedness was exposed to shame. We know that nakedness is shameful. We cover ourselves up when we're not sufficiently clothed because we're ashamed of our nakedness. And we'll note, as it pertains to the sexually attractive portion of this lesson, that there is an area where nakedness is not shameful, but that would be in the marriage relationship. And so marriage or nakedness outside of marriage and any other spectrum of our lives, of course, is shameful. And propriety is the character and the kind of thought that understands the shame of nakedness. And moderation in this text is closely and importantly linked to this. It's the Greek word sophrosyne, and it means a soundness of mind, literally sanity, or figuratively self-control. And it's very important as it pertains to propriety, because it is the wherewithal and the soundness of mind that is going to be able to, with that understanding of propriety, a shame of nakedness, then dress appropriately. And so I know it's shameful to be naked. And so since I know it's shameful to be naked, I'm going to think soundly, use good judgment to cover the nakedness. Again, it implies concerted effort. It takes effort. Trench says it is that habitual inner self-government with its constant reign on all the passions and desires which would hinder the temptation to these from arising, or at all events from arising in such strength as would overbear the checks and barriers which eidos, or shamefastness, or propriety, opposed to it. I know that propriety is a sense of shame, concerning nakedness especially, and so I'm going to dress with sound judgment to cover that as it pertains to God's standard. We move on to verse 10 to note the goal that we have in mind. This is especially important as we consider the practical applications of modest dress this morning. Our goal is to profess godliness. And essentially what the writer here, Paul, is saying is that instead of dressing in this way and professing this, you're trying to profess godliness. So what people should see is not what you're wearing with braided hair, gold, costly clothing. That's part of it, but also clothing that is insufficient. They shouldn't be seeing that and be distracted by that. And you shouldn't be defined as that. That shouldn't reflect the inner person that is rebellious, so on and so forth. But it should be reflecting a godly person. And namely, you do that by being obedient. Your good works, in other words, are your apparel. He's not saying that that's all that modest dress is, that we're an obedient Christian. We must wear physical clothing that is modest. What he's saying is that when you're wearing the physical clothing, it should be of the sort according to God's standard, and therefore reflecting that your main goal is to be pleasing to God. Not only do your good works express that godly character, but your dress manifests it outwardly. And so by our apparel, we're trying to avoid professing anything other than our being obedient to God and concerned with His will. That is, that attention is not drawn to us on our fault and on our part, where the focus is on what we're wearing or not wearing and a distraction from what we are as a Christian. People may do that anyway, but if it's up to us, that ought not be the case. And if we're dressing according to God's modest standard, it won't be the case. Essentially, we're trying to do what Jesus commanded us to do in Matthew 5 and in verse 16. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. If you dress them modestly, it's going to distract those men from Christ being in you. But especially as we get to the practical portion of the consideration of our study of modesty, I think it's important to emphasize that word moderation. Moderation is the New King James Version translation. It's translated sobriety in the American Standard Version, self-control in the English Standard Version, and discreetly in the New American Standard Bible. And so as it's translated discreetly, it's not simply meaning kind of under the radar. That might play a part of it. I think it certainly does. But it means we're careful about our dress. We're circumspect about our dress. We're dressing prudently with sound judgment. That's what Vine says, that sound judgment practically expresses the meaning and the Greek word sophrosyne, or moderation, as it's translated in the New King James Version. I thought that Bauer and Gingrich gave a great consideration of this word. They say it is the practice of prudence, good judgment, moderation, and notice especially this, it is the practice of self-control as exercise of care and intelligence, we're thinking about it, appropriate to circumstances. And we ask the question, what is the circumstance? Well, it's the goal. What are we trying to profess with our outward apparel? Godliness. We're people that are mindful of God, and we want people to be drawn to Him through what they see in us. Not us. It's not about us. We don't want them to see us. We want them to see God in us. We want them to be drawn to God. 1 Peter chapter 2 says that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works that shaves are glorify God in the day of visitation. They don't glorify you. They glorify God. They don't focus their attention on you, but what you're doing that is Christ living in you. That's the circumstance. And what moderation in modest dress does is it controls itself. It controls you. You control yourself with the care and thoughtfulness about that goal. That is literally, when I put on clothes to go to work or to go to school, when I dress myself in the morning to go out in public, I literally stand in front of the mirror. You may already know that what you're wearing is fine, but you stand in front of the mirror because you want to be careful and you make sure that it's according to God's standard, because when you go out into public, you're not trying to get people to be distracted by what you are wearing or aren't wearing. We don't want people to see who we are outwardly as a worldly person or a materialistic person. We want them to see that we're dressed according to God's standard, and we simply want our emphasis in life not to be on what we're wearing necessarily, but who we are as a Christian. We want them to see God through what we're doing. That requires good judgment. It requires a knowledge of God's will. It is the good judgment in conjunction with the governance of God's will, His standard. What is modest attire? So it's not saying, I think that this will point people to God. I don't think this will distract people from who I am as a Christian and therefore glorify God. It's what does God say will be distracting? That's the point. Let God be true and every man a liar. In other words, we're to be those who profess godliness, which means our outward apparel needs to profess godliness. We need to ask ourselves that question when we do get dressed and look at ourselves. Am I professing anything other than godliness here? If it's not according to God's standard, it obviously isn't professing godliness. As we'll note, if it's ostentatious, it's too loud and distracting, it's too in their face where they're not thinking about anything about, look at what they have on and what they're trying to tell us with what they have on, then it's not going to bring attention to God. Hence, we have the first end of the spectrum, which is what we see there in verse 9, that women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, and note this, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness, namely with good works. He says, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing. And we affirm what we affirmed last Sunday, that he is not condemning the wearing of jewelry. He's not condemning the wearing of makeup. He's not condemning anything inherently wrong about those matters. Braided hair, gold, pearls, or even costly clothing, as long as it's not the costly clothing that, as we noted last time in that culture, was actually immodest, see-through clothing. If that's the costly clothing you're wearing and it's not covering nakedness, then we ought not wear it. But he's not condemning that as an inherent sin. Jewelry is not inherently sinful. But what he is doing is he's condemning something that eclipses who that woman is as a Christian. If people look at you and they think that's what you're about, it's all about the flash, it's all about the style, it's all about the money I have that gives me the wherewithal to dress in this way, it is loud and in your face, and that's what they see when you go out and you're dressed, and they don't consider that that person is just one who wants to do what's right before God, and they're not concerned with this life, they're concerned with spiritual things. If it distracts people from who you are as a Christian, and if it distracts them from God being seen in you, that is the sin that he's describing, not with braided hair, gold, pearls, or costly clothing. We noted that as it pertains to the text of 1 Peter chapter 3, in verse 3, where concerning a wife who is a Christian before her unbelieving husband, trying to win him over to the gospel, they said, let them observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear, and maybe they'll be won over. But notice verse 3, he gets more specific. Do not let your adornment be merely outward, but arranging the hair, wearing gold, putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty and of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. The New King James translators actually put in a word which is implied in the not but construction. He says, not with this, but with this, or not with this, rather with this, in 1 Peter chapter 3. If you have the New King James Version, you might notice that merely is italicized. It's because it's not in the original Greek, but it is indeed implied. That's what a not but statement boasts of. It says, not merely this, but especially this. And so what's the emphasis on? The emphasis on, a godly character, namely one with good works, that is not distracted and taken away from with immodest apparel. That's our focus, not merely this. And so if the mere thing supersedes what is the ultimate goal, then it's immodest apparel. It's ostentatious. It's loud. It's in your face. It's taking away from what you're trying to profess, namely godliness accomplished through good works, one of which is submission to God and His standard of modesty. I want us to consider this quote from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, the 1915 edition, on a section of women concerning especially their apparel. Speaking of Christian women in the first century, a man named James Orr wrote, "They no longer needed the former splendor of outward adornment because they were clothed with the beauty and simplicity of Christ-like character. They exchanged the temples, theaters, and festivals of paganism for the home, labored with their hands, cared for their husbands and children, graciously dispensed Christian hospitality, nourished their spiritual life in the worship service of the church. Their modesty and simplicity were a rebuke to and reaction from the shameless extravagances and immoralities of heathenism. That they were among the most conspicuous examples of the transforming power of Christianity is manifest from the admiration and astonishment of the pagan Libanius, who exclaimed, 'What women these Christians have!'" That's what modest attire does. Not concerned with all the flashiness of the pagan society as it pertained to Christian women in the first century. But my adornment now, the most important thing in my life, is not how flashy I can be, how much attention I can draw, but it's how many people I can attract to Christ. And I'm going to do that by being submissive to His will. Namely, as a woman in this context, they were those who exchanged those things for the home and labored with their hands and cared for their husbands and children, and they submitted to Christ's law always. You know, I think it's especially important to note that with not just the pagans in the culture that Timothy would be dealing with in Ephesus, but even in the Jewish culture, ostentation was a big problem. And it was always something condemned by God. You're taking the focus away from who you are as a Jew, a child of God, or a Christian that would ultimately point people to me. And you're wanting it to be all about yourself. That's what ostentatious dress is. And it's an excess of dress. We're not talking about the insufficient dress. We're talking about the excess of dress. And that is equally sinful. It's always been a problem. We see that in Isaiah, the third chapter. And the prophets, they are filled with condemnations and reprovings of those who were unfaithful to God, warnings about destruction and doom to come. And one of the things that Judah needed to be warned of, that evidently they didn't fully repent of because they were taken captive as well and Jerusalem destroyed, was their women and their ostentation that they displayed. In Isaiah 3 and verse 16, "Moreover, the Lord says, because the daughters of Zion are haughty, and walk with outstretched necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, making a jingling with their feet. Therefore the Lord will strike with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will uncover their secret parts. And the day the Lord will take away the finery, the jingling anklets, the scarves and the crescents, the pendants, the bracelets and the veils, the headdresses, the leg ornaments and the headbands, the perfume boxes, the charms and the rings, the nose jewels, the festal apparel and the mantles, the outer garments, the purses, the mirrors, the fine linen, the turbans and the robes. And so it shall be, instead of a sweet smell, there will be stench. Instead of a sash, a rope. Instead of well-set hair, baldness. Instead of a rich robe, a girding, a sackcloth. And branding instead of beauty. Your men shall fall by the sword, your mighty men, and your mighty in the war. Her gates shall lament and mourn, and she being desolate shall sit on the ground." You know, when we first read that, it kind of takes us aback. They had a ton of stuff. I mean, they were wearing all the things that were just described. How much stuff did they have to put on in the morning? But really, if we really think about it, you consider a common dress in our culture today, which is ostentatious. The list may be different, but it's probably just as long, if not longer. And the condemnation here was not that these things inherently were wrong, but they were decked to it in an excessive way so that attention was drawn to them. It says that they were jingling their jewelry. They were mincing about. That means they were dancing about in a way that would draw attention. They were essentially looking at everyone and dressing themselves with this excess of jewelry and jumping around to the point of it jingling so that they could get attention. It's all about me. It calls them haughty. It calls them prideful. They're arrogant women, and they're dressing in excess, which in and of itself is condemned as sin. And you know, a man could be just as guilty of this as a woman, but it was especially a problem of the women in Judah, that they were ostentatious. In the College Press Bible Study textbook series, the commentator on Isaiah says this of the text: "The women were haughty and proud and concerned with luxurious adornment of themselves in order to bring attention to themselves." That's exactly what we read. This is immodesty. Proper adornment and true beauty in women should never call attention to themselves, but should direct the beholder's attention to God and His Son. This is what Paul said of the life that he lived after he came up out of the watery grave of baptism. "I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. In the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me." We have another "not but" sentence structure. Paul wasn't saying that he was dead physically, that he didn't do anything physically anymore. He no longer lives. He says, "It is no longer I who merely live, but especially Christ who lives in me." He said, Paul is no more because Christ is overwhelming who Paul is. Christ is controlling my life. The man we saw that Christ was described in the Gospels is who I'm trying to be, not so that people can say, "Look at how great Paul was," but so they can imitate me as I imitate Christ, 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 1. And so our adornment needs not be like that of the women of Judah, where we're jingling around, whatever it is, that we're wearing ostentatious dress, loud dress, which is all about, "Look at what I have on, look at what I'm wearing." And people stop and they see you because it's not normal, it's flashy, it's in your face. That's not what a Christian dress is like. That takes focus away from God and puts it on the person. Our goal is for people to see Christ in us. Our goal is not to distract men from God, but to draw their attention to God. But what is ostentatious dress? I know we know what it is. We know what ostentation means, I think. And maybe this isn't the perfect word to describe all facets of what we're discussing this morning, but it is indeed the principle we see when Paul says, "Not with braided hair, gold, pearls, costly clothing, but which is proper for a woman professing godliness with good works." But what really does it look like? I want to tell you that ostentatious dress, dress that is immodest on this end of the spectrum and therefore is sinful to dress in that way, is any kind of dress whatsoever that places self before God. And here's where the moderation comes in that we emphasized before in the language of 1 Timothy 2 and verses 9 and 10. Be honest with yourself pertaining to what God's law says that we should be professing as a Christian, seeing Christ in us, not about us. No longer I who live, Christ lives in me. Is my dress meant for placing myself out in front and God behind me? If we didn't think that's what it was, but we observe what we're wearing and think, well, maybe that would be distracting and take attention away from God and make it about me, then maybe we need to change. But we got to use sound judgment. We got to make sure that that is not the case. You know, especially as it pertains to this end of the spectrum, certainly the other end of the spectrum with sexually attractive dress, but I think especially with this, we hear this kind of phrase often, that it's my body and I can do with it what I want. I want to tell you that in and of itself does not express a godly character. It expresses a selfish, prideful, arrogant, and rebellious character. And it may be in the context of someone saying, "You don't get to tell me how I dress," but it certainly has been, in my experience, in the context of, "God doesn't get to tell me how I dress. It's my body. I can do with it what I want." And we need to have sound judgment. We need to ask the question, is it really our body? This is certainly something, a phrase that we hear from time to time when we're talking about tattoos all over the body, sometimes on the face, where it's just so blaring and glaring and obvious, and you know, people with tattoos, even though it's getting more and more commonplace and almost ubiquitous, I looked up a few statistics, even though it's beginning to be universal, the smaller population is still those who wear those tattoos. They're not in the majority, not even yet. And when someone comes out and they're decked in tattoos, they're painted all over their body, you have head turns everywhere. It's about, look at them, look at what's on their body. And that's the whole idea of a tattoo. You get a tattoo in a public place where it's going to be showing. It's not covered up. What is it for? It's so other people can see it. They can observe it. And a lot of times, and even with excessive piercings, we're not talking about a couple of earrings. We're talking about piercings all over. You see metal, not an ear. Or piercings all in the face or all over the body. And we see the extremes of those, but we see those who are kind of in the middle, and it's still pretty excessive. It's not normal. It causes people to turn their heads, brings attention on them. And a lot of times when we bring those kinds of things up, immediately the thought is, it's my body and I can do whatever I want with it. Again, that manifests in and of itself an ungodly character. We need to ask that question. Well, is it our body? In 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, we see otherwise. In verse 13, speaking of sexual immorality, Paul says the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord. He's talking about sexual immorality. But it would not be inaccurate to say the body is for the Lord and the Lord for the body. That's exactly what he says. Now, I'm applying it in the realm of sexual immorality. It's not to be used in that way. But it's saying the body is for the Lord and the Lord for the body. Verse 19, he says this, "Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? For you are bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's." And it almost seems like a paradox. Your body and your spirit, which are God's, whose is it? Did you create your body? Did you go to the supermarket and pick your body up off of the shelf and choose that one? Tell you what, a lot of times we're not really happy with our body as far as physical fitness goes. We want to make a change or something. We choose to have something else, but it takes hard work and need to put in the work. We wouldn't have chosen this body. But did you choose it? It was given to you. God created you with it. And it may be yours to inhabit, but it's yours to inhabit as a steward. We're a steward of our bodies. It doesn't belong to us. Not any more than the money belonged to the stewards of the parable of the just steward, where they were given money and they were given money to do with it. And the one who didn't do anything with it and gave it back the same portion that was given to them, they were cast into outer darkness. It doesn't belong to you, and you didn't do with it what I told you to do with it. That's what God's saying. Maybe your body, but it's your body to be a steward over according to God's will. Your body and your spirit are God's. It's for God's glory, not your glory. It's for God's service, not your service. Romans 6 and verse 13, still in the context of sin, but can be applied generally. Present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead. And your members, that's a metaphor for our bodies, any part of our body, as instruments of righteousness to God, not to sin. And certainly not taking away from its purpose as an instrument. I want us to consider this illustration he uses in the 19th verse of 1 Corinthians 6. He says, "Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who's in you, whom you have from God and you are not your own? Therefore glorify God in your body." Immediately, that word temple will draw our attention to the Old Testament. It's an Old Testament reference. And when it's used figuratively, it has to have a literal significance to it. There's got to be something literally about the temple that makes sense, is logical, and is according to God's law that we read of in the Old Testament for this metaphor to apply anywhere in the New Testament concerning our bodies. It wouldn't make sense for him to bring that up any more than it would have made sense for him to bring up in Isaiah the uncovering of the thigh to be nakedness, if the uncovering of the thigh not to be nakedness. It doesn't make sense to say that's shameful for Babylon, who'll be carried away metaphorically, the shame of her nakedness uncovered, if the shame of nakedness uncovering the thigh wasn't actually shameful. And so when he says your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, he's trying to get us to draw kind of a similarity and a parallel. Someone says, it's my body and I can do with it what I want, so I'm going to pierce it all over. I'm going to change it and alter it in permanent ways. I'm going to tattoo it and be a billboard to show myself to the world with whatever it is my fancy in my mind. I'll put it on my body permanently. And we think about that in regard to the temple. Would a Jew who certainly goes to the temple and worships acceptably because he is of the people of God, it's for the Jews, would he ever think of saying, it's my temple, because I'm a Jew. It's how I worship God. It's how I serve God. I'm a Jew. Not Gentiles come to, I'm a Jew, I come to the temple. Would that Jew ever think of, since it's my temple, I worship God in this temple, I'm going to paint it the color red? Did God say anything about that when he gave Solomon instruction for the temple? Did he say anything about that when he gave Moses the example for the tabernacle? No, he said, as Hebrew 8, verse 5 records, see all that you make all things according to the pattern. There was a pattern. God expected us or them to worship God in the temple acceptably, but for it to be built acceptably. Would anyone ever walk up to the temple and say, well, you know what? I really was thinking about this over here. Here's a hobby I have. So I'm going to just draw a bunch of pictures of what I like to do as a hobby on here because I want people to know about it. I'm going to just spray paint it, carve it onto this temple wall. Would they ever just say, I don't like this wall, so I'm going to bust it down? Or I don't like that it's gold inlaid. I'm going to take all the gold out. I'm going to put silver or bronze in because that's just what I like more. I want it to be different. God said, I want it to be this way, but you know, it's my temple. I worship there, so I'm going to change it. You know, might say that that's radical. Certainly, Paul doesn't speak of that in detail, but if that's the figure, it applies. That's your body. You can't do with it what you want. It's God's body. It's his instrument. You know, he instructed how he wanted the temple built. Did he not intend for our body to be made in a certain way? David would argue he did. Psalm 139 in verse 14, he says, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. Psalm 139, 14. And some people take what he made and what should be marvelous and just in their eyes because God made it, and they want to mar it. They want to change it. They want to take away from that sight and distract others with something else. Take away from God's magnificent and wonderful creation of the human body that declares the glory of God just as much as the design of the heavens declare the glory of God in Psalm 19 and verse 1. And they want to put things all over it and cover up what God made. And not only to that, but not glorify God in their bodies, but instead, look at me and what I have. Look at what I've done to my body because it's my body and I can do with my body what I want. Does that profess a godly character? I do not think so. I want to say that adornment is different than defacement. Someone says, well, you're talking about piercing, and you say that's wrong because you're taking the focus away from your body. There's a difference in adornment and defacement, or adornment and distraction. An adornment describes not the attention being brought to the ornament, but the ornament bringing attention to its object it's hanging on. That's what it's about. That's what adornment is. Last Sunday night, I preached on adorning the doctrine. Are we taking any focus away from the gospel of Christ when we adorn it with our obedience to it? No, it's us that's adorning it. And we're all individuals, so we're adorning it in different ways. We come from different backgrounds. We've repented of different sins. We come from different places. And so when we obey the gospel, it means a little bit different to those people that we know and observe us. We're adorning the doctrine, but what we're doing is pointing to the beauty of the gospel. Adornment is different than defacement. I would say that God does not want us to go out into public as slobs, because that draws attention to us as well. He doesn't want us to neglect our body. He wants us to take care of it. We're a steward of it. He wants us to make sure we are handling properly what he has entrusted to us. Not defacing it, maybe adorning it, but not defacing it or distracting people from who we are as Christians. You know, when we consider these things, sometimes someone might say, well, you can't say that that's inherently sinful. Maybe not. You can't say putting ink on the body is sinful. But most times, or a lot of times, the decision to do it in and of itself is sinful. Or it hinders us from carrying out what we're to carry out as Christians. Consider what Paul said in the same chapter, 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12. All things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. Obviously, jewelry inherently isn't sinful. Obviously, ink is not inherently sinful. Needles are not inherently sinful. Being stuck with a needle is obviously not inherently sinful. But when you put it into a context and an action like putting images all over yourself, decking yourself with piercings, And what that does is it hinders people to see Christ in you because it's ostentatious, it's glaring, it's in your face. That is sinful. And so we've got to use moderation, sound judgment concerning, as Bauer and Gingrich says, intelligent thought concerning the specific circumstance we're in. We're trying to profess godliness with good works. This may be lawful, but it's not lawful to use it in an unlawful way. It's not lawful to take people and distract them from Christ being seen in us. Galatians 6 and verse 14, Paul says he glories in the cross of Christ. He doesn't glory in anything else. Some people glory in themselves, not in the cross. Some people who are Christians are showing themselves to have more thoughts about themselves than Christ in the things that they wear or do to their body. Ostentatious dress is that which boasts of material things. In Matthew, the 6th chapter, we're to lay up our treasure in heaven where moth or rust don't destroy, thieves don't break in and steal, and where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. It's not decked to the nines in expensive wear just for people to see. You're decked to the nines in expensive wear. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, it says that we're to trust in God, not in uncertain riches. And instead, verse 19, we store up for ourselves a good foundation for the time to come and lay hold on eternal life. Those are the riches of good works. Again, that's the same context of the good works that we're to have in 1 Timothy chapter 2. An example of this would not just be wearing nice things. It's not wrong to get the nice brand instead of the off brand. What it is wrong to do is to deck yourself out in fancy clothes for the sake of people saying, look how much money they have. Look what things they have. Boy, I wish I could wear what they're wearing. I wish I could afford it. And a lot of people dress for that very purpose. That ought not be the case for a Christian. That takes focus away from God. And what we should be reflecting is that I don't care about the material things. Yeah, I may have a nice thing here or there, but it's not who I am. It's not in your face. I care about spiritual blessings. People should be drawn to God in that way. Also, ostentatious dress is that which is contrary to a gentle and quiet spirit. We considered 1 Peter 3 and verse 3. Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. And it's contrasted, rather, especially, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. The condemnation here is dress, which was opposite of a gentle and quiet spirit. That's what ostentatious dress is. Linsky says that meek or gentle and quiet go together here. The doubling intensifies the virtue. The meekness is always quiet. Loudness, intemperate, irate speech and action are foreign to it. And a steady balanced strength in meekness keeps it on an even keel. I'd suggest to you it's the moderation of 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9. We have the strength of controlling ourselves with our dress, making sure that it's not loud, but it's a reflection of our meek and gentle spirit. You know, Christians are not even to be loud in their good deeds. Christians are to be meek and gentle and quiet. They're not to be attention seekers, but seekers of God. We should really fly under the radar in many ways. Not necessarily that we're keeping our good works quiet, but those are what we are and what people are seeing, not anything else. I want us to consider this in regards to culture too, though. A meek and gentle quiet spirit is going to conform to culture where it's not sinful to conform to culture. I understand, as Romans 12 and verse 2 says, we're not to be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of our mind. And you make that contrast. The contrast of conforming to the world is being conformed or transformed by God's will. And so the conforming to the world of Romans 12 and verse 2 is not simply being different for the sake of being different. It's being different from sin, being obedient to God's will. You don't conform to worldliness, sinfulness. What Paul is not saying is that you need to be different just for different sake, because he wasn't that way. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, he says he became all things to all men. To the Jews, he became a Jew. Those under the law. Those without law, as without law. To the weak, I became as weak. I become all things to all men that I might all by all means save some. But notice in verse 21, he said, not being without law toward God, but being under law toward Christ. And so a Christian is to conform to culture so as to not stand out and be loud, but maintain that gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. But only in the area where it is lawful. not being without law toward Christ. That's exactly what Paul was saying. He's not going to stroll up into the Jewish audience and be acting and doing things like a Gentile. He wouldn't go to a Jewish home and eat meat that is offered to idols or eat meat that is unclean. Because while that may be lawful for him to do, that would not be modest in his character, but we can also apply that to our attire. Harry Osborne goes to the Philippines several times a year. When he preaches at home, he's in a suit and tie. That's our culture. It's starting to not necessarily be our culture, but especially within conservative churches of Christ, that's pretty normal nowadays. And suits and ties are very cultural still, just not as predominant. He goes over to the Philippines. He wears what they wear. He doesn't want to be distracting while he's preaching. So in a way, modest dress is that which conforms to culture when it is in line with God's will. 2 Corinthians 8:21, Paul says that he provided honorable things not only in the sight of the Lord, but in the sight of men. We dress in line with our culture so as to not attract attention, because when someone comes in and they're wearing something that is not according to our culture, people notice. We're not to be drawing attention to ourselves. Again, it's not different for the sake of being different. That's a difference we need to have as it pertains to the difference from sin. We're to be those who fit in, really. We're to be those who exhibit Christ in our character, but are not attention seekers, but seekers of God. Consider some application. Is our dress taking away from God and placing it on self? If it is, it's ostentatious, it's immodest. Is our dress reflecting a gentle and quiet spirit, or is it contradicting a gentle and quiet spirit? If it's contradicting the gentle and quiet spirit, then it is immodest. Things like tattoos everywhere, even brightly, unnaturally colored hair. Why do people dye their hair bright pink? It may be just because they like it, but what do people do when they see someone walk by with bright pink hair? They know they weren't born in the world of Dr. Seuss. That it's not natural. It's not ordinary. They look at it, and that's what it is. It's for attention. Why would that be befitting a Christian? It's not. That's immodest. That's ostentatious. It's flashy. What about excessive piercing? Not tasteful piercing, according to culture, but excessive piercing. It's a distraction. People see it and they think how weird or how unnatural or how out of place. It's not something that people think is just normal. Flashy jewelry, flashy clothes. You could go on and on. Ostentatious dress. You know, someone might, though, pull this card. But that's a part of our culture. I'm just conforming to culture. I'm trying to be like everyone else. I mentioned before that the statistics of tattoos will show you that those who wear tattoos and have tattoos and continually get tattoos, they're actually not in the majority, believe it or not. A lot of people have tattoos, but not the majority of the populace. And so really, it's not conforming fully to the culture. But even if it is, it's a part of the culture we live in, and really it is. Tattoos, excessive piercings, brightly colored hair, crazy clothes, you know, people that wear clothes so they seek attention and get attention, and people see that. But is that culture, which may be accepted in this time, contrary to the character that God commands us to have? Much of that is a rebellious culture. That's the whole concept of it's my body and I can do with it what I want. That's rebellion. People may not understand that in saying that they're rebelling against God, but that's exactly what it is. It's rebellion. Or I don't care what society says. That's rebellion. When we say I don't care what society is, and as it pertains to the laws of the land that contradict the laws of God, certainly we're saying, you know, I'm rebelling against the law of the land, but it's in conformity and transforming our minds by God's will. And that's different. When Peter in Acts chapter 4 said we ought to obey God rather than men, that's completely different. People who are rebellious are not people who are right with God. And a lot of that culture is about rebellion. It's certainly about attention seeking. It's even more so about pride. A lot of times it's about materialism. None of those things should be descriptions of the Christian character. They aren't descriptions of the Christian character. You know, a lot of times we tend to focus on the lesser side of things with modesty. That is sexually attractive dress. We'll get to that this evening. Clothing that is insufficient. But this is just as evil and sinful, to be seeking attention for self, to take the attention away from God. to be loud rather than gentle and quiet, like God calls Christians to be. The Proverbs tell us about a loud person, a loud mouth, one who speaks before he thinks, one who's always speaking, one who's always talking. They show themselves to be fools. Christians don't have that kind of character. Christ didn't have that kind of character. He was a gentle and quiet spirit. And we're to have the same, not wearing ostentatious attire, but wearing that attire which is proper for those who profess godliness, our emphasis being good works. If you have not obeyed the gospel and you're here this morning, we want to give you an invitation to do so. We know that the things we spoke of this morning do not pertain to the pure milk of the word, but it's pretty simple. Christ died on the cross for your sins. Without that sacrifice, you have no remission of sins. But he conquered death the third day, and he reigns as king in heaven, your king, the one we're to submit to. And his marching orders and command for men to go preach the gospel included, he who believes and is baptized will be saved. He who does not believe will be condemned. And when he comes back, and he is coming back, that's how you'll be judged in part. We'll be judged by the word in that day, John 12:48. And so we urge you and plead with you to obey that word this morning if you haven't already. And if you have been obedient to it, but you've fallen short in any sense or way, we want to give you the invitation as well to make things right for us to aid you in any spiritual way. Come forward while we stand and sing the song that was selected.